Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Welcome to Saturday Frights, the podcast. I am your co-host, the Projectionist. And now, for your host, Vic Sage.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to the Saturday Frights podcast. This week, we have an excellent 1933 movie to discuss, James Whale's film adaptation of H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man.
Yes, Victor. It stars Claude Rains, Gloria Stewart, William Harrigan, Henry Travers, and of course, Una O'Connor as her usual character, a woman in high hysterics. This, dear listeners, is a film worthy of the title of being a classic motion picture.
I love this film, Projectionist. Of course, I absolutely adore all of the Universal Monster movies. Frankenstein, Dracula, The Wolfman, The Phantom of the Opera, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Bride of Frankenstein, and The Mummy. And The Invisible Man, of course. Although, he perhaps didn't quite become the icon that his fellow monsters became.
That might be because of the type of monster the Invisible Man represents, Sage. With Frankenstein's monster, the Wolfman, and the Creature from the Black Lagoon, there was a great deal of pity that the audience felt for the characters.
Yeah? Dracula, I suppose, does what he does for love, as does the Phantom of the Opera and the Mummy, but they are pretty evil when you get down to it. I would even say that perhaps the Creature leans a little towards the dark side.
He's protecting his home, Victor. The scientist, while having the best of intentions, are quite truthfully the intruders to the Black Lagoon.
I agree with that, my friend. It gets a little sticky, though, on who is evil and good, right? I mean, in The Invisible Man, Dr. Jack Griffin becomes evil due to an unforeseen side effect of the invisibility serum. But perhaps we should halt the good and evil discussion for now and jump to the synopsis.
Most certainly.
As I've already mentioned, The Invisible Man was directed by James Whale. It was adapted from H.G. Wells' 1897 novel of the same name.
Excuse the interruption, Sage. The film rights to The Invisible Man were secured from H.G. Wells himself for a princely sum of $10,000. The author even had script approval.
Well, that might explain why it took so many drafts before Universal Pictures and Wells settled on a screenplay, which was written by R.C. Sharif, who it turns out was recommended by the author himself. As the film begins proper, we are introduced to a stranger caught in a snowstorm, who makes his way to the little town of Iping in Sussex. There he finds lodging at the Lion's Head Inn. When he makes his entrance, it ceases all conversation in the little tavern. Dressed in a great black overcoat and hat, his face is hidden by a combination of dark glasses with blinders and gauze bandages. This stranger, although we aren't aware of it yet, is Dr. Jack Griffin, played sublimely by Claude Rains. And of course, the reason he wears such heavy clothing and bandages is he is suffering from a severe case of invisibility. Griffin is able to secure boarding at the inn, but things are less than rosy between him and the Lion's Head proprietors, in particular Jenny Hill, played by the hysterical Una O'Connor. Her constant nosing about upsets Griffin to no end, and it all comes to a head when he winds up being late on paying for his room and board. Jenny sends her husband up to evict the stranger, and things become violent, with Griffin shoving Mr. Hall down the stairs, which results in a constable being summoned to the inn to deal with the situation. Griffin is confronted in his rented room by the constable, and a mob of men who seem all too ready to help throw the stranger out. But Griffin gets the upper hand when he begins to remove his clothing and bandages, delighting in revealing his invisibility. The constable tries to stop him by having the others form a line to block the door. But once Griffin starts to throttle the police officer, they are all too stunned to stop him from pushing his way out of the inn and to freedom. While Griffin is terrorizing the countryside, unbeknownst to him, his fiancée, Flora Cranley, played by the beautiful Gloria Stewart, is naturally worried by the disappearance of Jack Griffin. Her father, who employs Jack, is equally worried, especially when he discovers that Griffin was experimenting with a dangerous chemical called monocaine. We learn why it's a danger when Dr. Cranley's other assistant, Dr. Arthur Kemp, who is portrayed by William Harrigan, asks why the older man is so worried. Apparently, when using monocaine to experiment on a dog, it ended up driving the poor animal insane. Sound like anyone we know who might be showing signs of those symptoms? I think I should add that Harrigan does a great job as Kemp, who I think it's safe to say has been playing second fiddle to Griffin, and he even has his eyes on Flora. What I'm getting at is he's a weasel. Oh, before I forget, Dr. Cranley is played by the legendary character actor Henry Travers. Kemp has an unexpected shock as he returns home. It turns out Griffin, upon leaving the end, has turned up at his fellow doctor's house. The obviously mad scientist uses fear to make Kemp a partner in crime. Going back to the inn, Griffin is able to grab his lab books from his old room. Unfortunate for the constable who's conducting an inquiry within the inn. The officer obviously doesn't believe the townsfolk, and in anger at being called a hoax, Griffin murders the poor man before gleefully making his escape. When they return, Kemp is able to contact Dr. Cranley, begging for assistance before he calls the police. Flora overhears the conversation and is able to convince her father that her love can possibly snap Griffin out of his insanity. And to be fair, when they meet, he does start to behave more civilized. For a moment. And then we learn how far he plans to go with his invisibility serum.
I wanted to do something tremendous. To achieve what men of science have dreamt of since the world began. To gain wealth and fame and honor. To write my name above the greatest scientists of all time. I was so pitifully poor. I had nothing to offer you, Flora. I was just a poor, struggling chemist. I shall come back to you, Flora, very soon now. The secret of invisibility lies there in my books. I shall work in Kent's laboratory till I find the way back. There is a way back, Flora, and then I shall come to you. I shall offer my secret to the world with all its terrible power. The nations of the world will bid for it, thousands, millions. The nation that wins my secret can sweep the world with invisible armies.
Jack, I want you to let my father help you. You know how clever he is. He'll work with you day and night until you find that second secret, the one that'll bring you back to us. Then we'll have those lovely, peaceful days again, out under the trees, after your work in the evening.
Your father? Clever? You think he can help me? He's got the brain of a tapeworm, a maggot beside mine. Don't you see what it means? Power. Power to rule, to make the world grovel at my feet.
Jack, listen to me. Listen. My father found a note in your room. He knows something about monocaine even you don't know. It alters you, changes you, makes you feel differently. Father believes the power of it will go if you know what you're fighting. Oh, come and stay with us. Let's fight this thing out together.
Power, I said. Power to walk into the gold vaults of the nations, into the secrets of kings, into the holy of holies. Power to make multitudes run squealing in terror at the touch of my little invisible finger. Even the moon's frightened of me. Frightened to death. The whole world's frightened to death.
I'm going to stop with a synopsis there, friends. Can Flora and her father find a cure for Griffin? Is there anything at all that can stop the invisible madman from his killing spree? The answers to that, you will have to find out for yourself when you watch The Invisible Man.
Listeners, The Invisible Man is what I would call a masterpiece. Every single person on the film was at the top of their game. I can assure you that audiences of the day were gobsmacked by seeing Invisible Man up on the silver screen.
I find the effects are still quite amazing, projectionist. To think this was accomplished back in 1933 is more than a little impressive.
That is all thanks to Universal Pictures effects technicians Victor, John Mescal, John Fulton, and Frank Williams. When Claude Rains was needed to be shown taking off his clothes and bandages, they had the thespian wear black velvet tights underneath his outfit, with a black helmet over his head, with black gloves for his hands, while shooting him against a black velvet background. Combining that footage with the background image in the arduous matte process. I have heard the technicians were forced to use small brushes and opaque dye on the film itself with the aid of microscopes to hand-correct thousands upon thousands of frames of film in that process.
Holy cow! Talk about dedication to your craft, right? Obviously, they used wires to move things around when Griffin was completely invisible. Like when he throws a bottle of chemicals at the mob, etc.
They most certainly did. I wonder, when did you first see this film, Sage?
Well, as I've mentioned on the podcast and on the Retro site many times before, I was primed at a young age to be a Universal Monsters fan. My father, waking up in the middle of the night to find his 3-year-old son watching 1931's Frankenstein, fitting as that was also directed by James Whale. I didn't actually get to see this film until I was in high school.
What?
Yeah, it's true. Thanks to my high school drama teacher, Mr. Rosenauer, who would once a week during our class show us films that he felt were classics. I was totally blown away by the film, so much so that I begged my father to take me to our local Hastings so I could buy it on VHS.
How odd! You were not able to see this film before your young adulthood!
Please remember that for the most part in my neck of the woods, we didn't have a creature feature or a midnight movie on Saturday nights. I agree with you, by the way, on what you said earlier about the film being a showcase for talent. Everyone does a great job, of course, but I feel the movie is really carried aloft on Claude Rains' astounding acting skills.
Indeed. Did you know he was not the studio's first pick to portray Dr. Jack Griffin?
Really? Who did they have in mind then?
Boris Karloff.
I guess that makes sense, what with him working on Frankenstein and then The Mummy in 1932. He was Universal Pictures' go-to guy for horror, it would seem.
Absolutely, Victor. It has been reported that he didn't want the part as Dr. Jack Griffin isn't visible until the end of the film.
Hey, spoilers there, friend. That doesn't really sound like Karloff to me.
Agreed. I've also heard it was due to the tight purse strings that Carl Remley was holding. I believe it was more likely the director James Whale wished to find an actor with a clearer manner of speech. It's been said that James Whale overheard from another screening room Claude Rains' screen test for the studio, and felt he would suit the role better than Boris Karloff.
Interesting. Of course, Karloff and Wales would work together again in 1935's Bride of Frankenstein, so there was obviously no hard feelings there. Back to The Invisible Man, Rains really knocks it out of the ballpark in the way he handles his character. Yes, he does the over-the-top stuff wonderfully, cackling as he strikes fear into those who oppose him. But he also lets the more human side, the good side of Griffin, show through in subtle ways. It's like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, Griffin is evil, but because he's been driven insane, you can't help but feel a little sorry for him.
Perhaps.
What do you mean, projectionist?
Tell me, Victor, why was Dr. Jack Griffin developing the serum?
Well, to become famous. To become in his own mind worthy of Flora's affections. I mean, hey, I'll be brutally honest here with you and the listeners. It's not like I don't have my doubts of worth in regards to my wife, you know?
You're married?
Yeah, for 10 years. Projectionist, you've heard me talking to my wife on the phone before.
I just thought that was your mother. No matter. What I'm hinting at, Sage, is that perhaps Dr. Jack Griffin's goal for the invisibility serum wasn't all academic, but designed for financial gain. Perhaps the good doctor's ego was always pushing him to the side of evil. An aspect that was finally unfettered when he became invisible.
I'll partially agree with you. I guess all of us have a trickster side and enjoy the thoughts of frightening people by moving objects in front of them or yanking hats off the unwary. Doing so without being caught, I mean.
In the film, it's hard not to laugh at his invisible antics.
Projectionist, you can't really laugh when he's overturning baby carriages or derailing trains that kill hundreds of people.
I guess comedy is in the eye of the beholder.
You really scare me sometimes, Projectionist. There are quite a few minor roles in the film played by famous actors. When Griffin steals a bicycle, it's from none other than Rio Bravo's Walter Brennan. A newspaper reporter on the scene was played by Dracula and Frankenstein's Dwight Fry. And then, future Dracula himself, John Carradine, portrays an informer to the police in the movie. Projectionist, did audience members faint or anything like they did with Frankenstein?
Not at all. Although, they were certainly shocked by certain scenes. You remember, this was a pre-code film. And when Dr. Jack Griffin begins to unrobe in his room at the Lion's Head Inn, there were more than a few female members of the audience that averted their eyes.
I would imagine so. Would you agree that Wales injected an amazing amount of black comedy into this movie?
Oh, indeed. Perhaps nearly as much as what is on display in Bride of Frankenstein.
Listeners, The Invisible Man seems to have done surprisingly well at the box office at that time.
Yes, it was incredibly popular, dear listeners.
Which is why I found it odd that it would take 7 years for another Invisible Man to appear at Universal with 1940's The Invisible Man Returns. Although this time it was the legendary Vincent Price who took the invisibility serum. That same year saw the release of The Invisible Woman, which starred Virginia Bruce, and was most definitely a comedy. In 1942, there was The Invisible Agent, which, believe it or not, friends, I've not had the pleasure of seeing.
You disappoint me, Victor.
Perhaps you can show it some evening on Saturday Frights. In The Invisible Agent, the grandson of Dr. Jack Griffin, so I guess Flora was pregnant, has immigrated to the U.S. under an assumed name, but is hunted down by Nazi officers. Escaping capture, he joins forces with the American government to be parachuted behind enemy lines to spy on the Nazis. In 1944, there was The Invisible Man's Revenge, which starred John Carradine as a scientist that experiments on John Hall, who plays Robert Griffin, a deranged killer who escapes a mental institution to use his newfound invisibility to take revenge on those he feels wronged him. The Invisible Man is featured at the end of 1948's charming Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, voiced by Vincent Price, although he's uncredited in the role. Then, in 1951, the three meet again in Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. In that film, the duo help a boxer accused of murder find the true killer, thanks, of course, to the athlete using the invisibility serum. Projectionist, I bet you have some vintage ads to share with our listeners before we dive into the notable cast and crew.
You know I do, Sage.
Count Dracula sleeps in this coffin, but rises every night at sunset. Chick is right. This is awful silly stuff.
Come on, take it all out.
Now! Look out, Chick! Come here! What's the matter? Come here!
Wait a minute! The nation's top comics, Abbott and Costello. Petrified, but hilariously. Plus the dangerous and terrifying Wolfman, played by Lon Chaney. Plus that fiend out of a nightmare, the vampire Batman, Count Dracula, played by Bela Lugosi. Plus the most dreaded creature of them all, the Frankenstein monster, played by Glenn Strange. Plus a couple of luscious but designing females, in the spookiest laugh fest on record.
Monster.
their first full-length feature in Technicolor.
Oh, hi there. I'm Herman Munster. And allow me to present my wife, Louie. And Grandpa, my handsome son, Eddie, and my niece, Marilyn. Co-starring Terry Thomas and Hermione Gingo. We inherit a million-dollar estate and a mansion full of homicidal relatives.
See Herman Munster in his Dracula challenge some of the world's fastest cars in history's weirdest race. See the Munsters in their first full-length feature in Technicolor. Munster, go home.
See you at the movies.
Victor, I feel, with it being the month-long celebration of October on the Retroist, that it would be a fine idea to discuss the rest of the Universal Monster films this month.
That sounds like a fantastic idea, my friend. But next week, we'll be talking about another Universal Pictures movie. This one, though, is from 1995.
Fine.
Director James Whale... Hey, stop that pouting, projectionist. Director James Whale passed away on May 29, 1957. He had garnered 23 directing credits, and besides Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein, he helmed such films as 1932's The Old Dark House, which featured Boris Karloff and Gloria Stewart, 1936's Showboat, 1939's The Man in the Iron Mask, and 1941's They Dare Not Love. Claude Rains passed away on May 30, 1967, and had earned 77 acting credits, with notable roles in 1935's The Mystery of Edwin Drood, 1938's The Adventures of Robin Hood, 1939's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1940's The Seahawk, 1941's Universal Monsters Classic, and, probably my favorite of the films, The Wolfman, 1942's Casablanca, 1943's The Phantom of the Opera remake, and 1962's Lawrence of Arabia, to name just a few. Gloria Stewart passed away on September 26, 2010, at the ripe old age of 100. She had 74 acting credits with notable appearances in Gold Diggers of 1935, which naturally came out in 1935. She was in 1936's The Crimes of Dr. Forbes, 1939's The Three Musketeers, 1944's The Whistler, which has nothing to do with the old-time radio series of the same name, 1982's My Favorite Year, 1986's Wildcats. But she is probably most famous for her role in a little-seen movie that came out in 1997, entitled Titanic. She was the oldest nominee in Academy Awards history when she was up for the Best Supporting Role, though sadly she didn't win the Oscar for her performance. William Harrigan passed away on February 1, 1966, with 44 credits to his name. Notable roles include 1935's G-Men, where he co-starred with James Cagney, 1936's Frankie and Johnny, 1951's The Flying Leathernecks, and 1957's Street of Sinners. Una O'Connor passed away on February 4, 1959, having earned 85 acting credits in such films as 1936's Little Lord Fauntleroy. She too was cast in 1938's The Adventures of Robin Hood, 1945's The Bells of St. Mary, 1948's The Adventures of Don Juan, and 1957's Witness for the Prosecution. Henry Travers passed away on October 18, 1965, at the age of 91. He had earned 52 acting credits, appearing along with Una O'Connor in 1945's The Bells of St. Mary, 1943's Shadow of a Doubt. But he's probably best known for his role as the lovable Clarence in 1946's holiday classic, It's a Wonderful Life. Friends, I think that about wraps up this episode. On behalf of the Projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. If you did enjoy the show, we hope you will hop on over to The Retroist every Saturday, where we present everything from classic horror TV shows to the best in frightening shorts. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our new ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys, and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
I do not care for current technological standards. But if you happen to find the bones of a raven and arrange it just so at midnight, we will be able to parley. But I am sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist Haunted Drive-In.
If you happen to be new to our show, we do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we'd love it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. The Saturday Frights podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher, and we would certainly appreciate it if you could click subscribe, maybe even leave us a nice review if you're pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows, or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself, for not only allowing us to record here in The Retroist Vault, but hosting the podcast as well. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, The Vault is sealed.
A stranger is coming.
Don't scream.
And he's hungry for their souls.
Just hear what I've got to say.
Now, they'll need all of their courage.
Well, like it or not, we stick together.
To fight the most dangerous evil of all. Tales from the Crypt presents Demon Knight.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye. Yeah.